Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Chanting is, hey, hey, ho, ho, Keystone Pipeline's got to go. And environmental activist Bill McKibben is with us now, fresh off leading those chants, tens of thousands of people in the protest against global warming in Washington over the weekend, aimed at President Obama, listening to some of the sound of that rally. McKibben is author of books, including Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, and founder of the climate campaign known as 350.org. Bill, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, it's always good to be with you, Brian.
First, tell us, why did you make President Obama the target of your rally when he just made global warming one of his official top priorities while the Congress continues to be dominated by science deniers?
Well, in the first place, he wasn't really the target. What we were saying and what I think everybody said from the stage was we're incredibly hopeful that he'll actually start doing some of the things that he's said he would do. That's what we've been saying for 18 months in this campaign against Keystone and in the larger climate campaign. There's no point, really, in trying to persuade the knuckleheads in the House of Representatives who won't take science seriously to do very much about climate. That means we're going to have to depend in the short term on the president to carry things out. And, of course, the single great test of this, as senator after scientist said on Sunday, was what he'll do about the Keystone Pipeline. He alone gets to make the call. No need to ask John Boehner. No need to do anything except stand up to the fossil fuel industry.
And we'll get into Keystone specifically and some other things that the president might do as we go along here. Listeners, if you want to talk to Bill McKibben today, 212-433-WNYC. That's our on-air line. We will never ask you for donations during Pledge Week when you're talking about content on the air. So call up to talk to Bill McKibben if you want to. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or you can post a comment or a question at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Let me replay what the president said about climate change in the State of the Union and then ask you a few things about it. I know you know this passage and everybody can hear it along with us.
I urge this Congress to get together, pursue a bipartisan market-based solution to climate change, like the one John McCain and Joe Lieberman worked on together a few years ago. But if Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will. I will direct my cabinet to come up with executive actions we can take now and in the future to reduce pollution, prepare our communities for the consequences of climate change, and speed the transition to more sustainable sources of energy.
So, President Obama from the State of the Union last week. Bill McKibben, was that about what you wanted to hear, or would you have put different words in his mouth if you had that power?
Well, here's the thing. President Obama said in 2008, when he, the night he won the nomination, he said, "My administration will be the one that sees the rise of the oceans begin to slow." He said, "We'll take on the tyranny of the oil industry." He's always said very good things, although he went completely silent about them like everybody else during the campaign. What's happened really in the intervening 4 years is the situation's gotten a hell of a lot worse. This past year, the hottest year in American history by a full degree, epic drought, the Arctic, the Arctic basically melted. There's a study out today saying that we're down to one-fifth of the ice that we had in the Arctic in 1980. We've taken one of the biggest physical features on Earth and we've broken it. I mean, we had a storm, as you might recall, in the fall, so intense that the IRT and the IND and the BMT were filling up with the Atlantic Ocean.
Right. And before we even get to Sandy, you mentioned the Arctic. I've mentioned on the show before that one of the most interesting articles that I've seen about global warming in months and months and months was actually about ice hockey rinks and the fact that they're building was actually in the sports section of the New York Times a few Saturdays ago, and how they're actually building indoor ice hockey rinks near the Arctic Circle,
yep,
because they don't have the winter-long freeze anymore for the future Wayne Gretzky's of the world to play outdoors. It's unbelievable, and it was in the sports section.
Yep. Look, here's and that's actually, in a way, the most important thing that's going on. Quite aside from all the debate in Washington and wherever else, you know, on the op-ed pages of the Times, people are noticing. The polling data about the people being scared of climate change is through the roof. There's been a huge spike in the last 2 years, and it's because 85% of American counties have had a federally declared disaster. I mean, at a certain point, it's like, what are you going to believe, the endless Exxon commercials on TV or your own lying eyes, you know?
Now, I'm going to push back here a little bit via New York Times columnist Joe Nocera. Maybe you saw his column today, who argues against you by name in his piece, which is called How Not to Fix Climate Change. So let me get your response to some of his specific arguments. For example, Nocera writes on the Keystone Pipeline that the president should approve it for at least two reasons. One, fossil fuels will be with us for some time to come while renewables are developed to mass scale. And it's better that we get our oil from Canada than, say, Venezuela, as he puts it. And two, he says Canada will keep extracting oil from those tar sands anyway. They'll just sell it to China instead of the United States. Does he have a point about those two things?
No, actually. The first part is, this oil is not staying in the U.S., as everyone has known now for more than a year, except, I guess, Mr. Nocera. These are refineries on the Gulf of Mexico, and this stuff is going to be exported overseas as soon as it arrives and is refined. As to the idea that the Canadians are just going to ship it to China via the Pacific, that was the strongest argument a year ago for building the Keystone Pipeline. They'll put it someplace else. But a little reporting would have made clear that it's no longer an argument. Our colleagues in Canada have done an unbelievable job of mounting resistance to that pipeline to the point where nobody thinks it's going to be built anytime in the foreseeable future. That's why the trade papers and the business press in Canada in the last couple of months have all been saying, without Keystone, there's no chance for the expansion of these tar sands production in Canada.
It is a very interesting development that just as there's resistance to the pipeline heading south to the Gulf of Mexico so the oil can get out around the world, in this country, there's new and growing resistance, especially by indigenous communities in western Alaska, to the alternative, which would be the pipeline in that direction that would go to Canada. But Nocera actually addresses that in his column, and he says it's backward logic, in his opinion, to think that if Canada simply winds up with all this oil and no place to sell it, that will therefore transition to renewables more quickly. He says only by reducing demand for oil will it become unprofitable for oil companies to produce. And, you know, he's written before about the electric car, for example. He's not a denier. He thinks the electric car is very promising because it's becoming affordable and it doesn't use gasoline. And he sees that as a much more productive route to fighting the oil companies and carbon emissions than trying to tell them that they're not allowed to look for oil. What do you think?
The point is, it's no longer an either or. We've got to do everything right from this point on. And even if we do everything right, we're going to catch a break from physics and to avoid complete catastrophe. We don't get to pick and choose between electric cars and pipelines. We've got to quickly. I mean, this is. I'm sorry, if I feel frustrated sometimes, it's because I wrote the first book about all this a quarter century ago. And I have to restrain myself sometimes from saying, if only you'd listen to me then, you know, because in 1989, there actually were lots of subtle course trajectory changes we could have made that would have landed us by now in a pretty good place. But the fossil fuel industry fought every one of those, and that's why we're now in the hole that we're in. I mean, and it is a big hole. 50 years from now, nobody is going to look back at our time and say, oh, how'd that fiscal cliff thing come out? All they're going to ask is, so the Arctic melted, and then what did you do? You know, that's why there was the largest climate rally, largest environmental gathering in decades in America Sunday in Washington in the cold. It was a beautiful, powerful day. That's why the biggest student movement in several decades has arisen in the last 6 months. 256 college campuses where students are demanding divestment from fossil fuel. I don't know whether we waited too long to get all this stuff started, but I'm happy as heck that it finally is started. I know that there are plenty of people, the sort of Jonas Eras of the world, who want things to proceed on a cautious, moderate basis. But the trouble is, we're not dealing in the end with the kind of political controversy we're used to dealing with. Our problem is not a fight between environmentalists and oil companies at the bottom. Our fight is a fight between human beings and physics. And that means that we've got to stop putting carbon into the atmosphere, and we've got to do it much more fast, much more quickly than we'll be comfortable.
And my guest on WNYC is the leader of Sunday's anti-climate change rally in Washington, environmental activist Bill McKibben, 212-433-WNYC. MJ in Sussex County, you're on the air. MJ, thanks for calling in.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to comment that I don't know that any change at the present time is going to be really possible as long as you have a Congress who denies that science exists. You have a president who talks a good story, but his environmental record is severely lacking. And you have a Supreme Court who needs a dictionary because they think that money is equivalent to speech. And as long as the oil companies are getting all the subsidies from the taxpayers, they're getting all the tax breaks, and then they're funneling that money into political campaigns, I don't see that we have a winning case here. I think that the people who have the power to make the change are just not interested in doing it. They're interested more in money.
MJ, thank you for your call. And, Bill, I told the listeners about a half hour ago that I would ask you about the Supreme Court, which, of course, you mentioned the Supreme Court, breaking news in the last hour. And I don't know if you've even heard this, but for those of you who would hope that they would revisit Citizens United and pull back on that, it seems, if anything, they're considering going in the other direction. Let me read you this from, this is from the USA Today version, which is on the web now, and it says, in a move that could signal the end of a key restriction on political giving, the Supreme Court announced it will consider a case challenging the limit on how much individuals can donate directly to federal candidates and political parties. So, Bill, as you know, if that means that currently they have to kind of go around the campaigns with these so-called independent groups that Citizens United helped to empower, if the Supreme Court rules a certain way in this case, they wouldn't even have to do that. All the special interests could just donate unlimited amounts of money directly to the candidates. Do you think that's relevant to the global warming fight?
I think it couldn't be more relevant. The biggest campaign contribution post-Citizens United came from Chevron in the closing days of this past election. It was all aimed at House races and designed to make sure that climate deniers remained in control of the House, which they did, and which means that there won't be. That's why we have to, you know, count on the president. There won't be climate legislation anytime soon. What it means is we have to build movements. It means that the only hope of standing up to the overwhelming money advantage of the fossil fuel industry is to find other currencies, you know, the currencies of movements, spirit, passion, creativity. Sometimes we have to spend our bodies. You know, last Wednesday, 50 leaders went to jail. People from, you know, Bobby Kennedy to the scientist Jim Hansen to on and on and on, saying, Mr. President, we need you. We need you to actually provide leadership here. This is the litmus test, and we need you to go to work. Look, it's not easy. I mean, and it's not like the president's immune to money either. While we were protesting on Sunday, he was playing golf in Florida. One of the people he was playing golf with was a oil executive who'd given big campaign contributions to the president. We know it's not easy. I have no idea whether we're going to win this fight, but at least now we're fighting. That's what that rally signified. It was the biggest rally about climate change that there's ever been, and there will be more because, you know, the antibodies, I hope, are starting to kick in.
And by the way, isn't it an unreported irony that the Washington Press Corps is all in flames about the White House not permitting them to photograph the president on that golf outing on Sunday because Tiger Woods was one of the other players, and apparently they didn't want the president to be seen with Tiger Woods. But we don't hear the Washington Press Corps saying, wait, you didn't let us get that image of you with the oil company executive that might actually have some relevance to why policy comes out the way it does. They're just concerned about seeing Tiger Woods.
Yes. I got to say, I can't completely blame the guy. There's something to be said for playing golf with Tiger Woods. But basically what happens is day in and day out, these guys get worked by the richest people on earth. And if we do not fight back with everything we can, I mean, the Keystone fight started 18 months ago with the largest civil disobedience action about anything in 30 years in this country. 1,250 people went to prison. That's why we were able to delay it for a year. The president said he'd give it more review. In the course of that year, Mother Nature filed about as compelling public testimony as she possibly could have. I mean, think about. I mean, you down there in Lower Manhattan, you lived right through the worst of it. I mean, think what it says about the fragility of the civilization we've built. That, you know, the Lower East Side became a kind of branch of the East River for a while.
So in this article that you had on Tom Dispatch and Huffington Post, you said we need the environmental equivalent of Pearl Harbor to wake up Washington. Was Sandy that equivalent? Is it happening now differently than it would have a few months ago?
I think things are somewhat different. I don't think they're different enough because the incredible power of that industry, it is the richest industry there ever was. And we're now just in a kind of pretty much straight out fight between money and science. And we're pretty far behind. I don't know if we can catch up. I do know that it depends on movement building. And I know that if the president blocks this pipeline, what it'll say is, A, movements work, and B, here I am, the first world leader ever to block a big project because of its effect on the climate. That would be a legacy, and that would give us something to turn to the Chinese and the others with and say, okay, ball's in your court for a little while now. Let's see what you guys can do.
We have 2 minutes left. Let me ask you about one, dare I call it an inconvenient fact, and that is the stats that have been coming out that say the U.S. is actually now below its 2005 carbon emission levels. They're actually going down, and that we will likely stay below 2005 levels until at least 2040 for a variety of reasons, and that one of those reasons is fracking for natural gas, and that whatever other environmental reasons we may have for being skeptical of fracking, it produces less carbon than energy from oil or coal, and if climate is your number one concern, it's a positive development, perhaps, at least as a transitional fuel. Where are you on that briefly?
Well, you know, I wrote a long piece for the New York Review of Books on fracking not long ago and sort of did all the research. There are two problems here. One is that, yes, it's reducing carbon, but at the expense of dramatically increasing methane, CH4, which is a potent greenhouse gas itself. So it's not at all clear on balance if it's doing any good. Second is cheap natural gas seems to be undercutting wind much more quickly even than coal, which means that in many ways it's delaying the transition to a kind of zero carbon future that we badly need. The International Energy Agency modeled a world that had gone entirely to natural gas, got rid of coal and oil altogether, just natural gas and renewables, and the temperature still went up 6 degrees. So what we need to do is get onto the sun and the wind. We can do it. I mean, there were days last summer when the Germans, the one country that ever took this seriously, generated more than half the power they used from solar panels within their borders. And this is Germany. I mean, this is not Nevada, you know. So we can do it. The question is, will we do it? And it all depends on standing up to money.
Bill McKibben, environmental activist. He led the anti-global warming rally in Washington on Sunday. He's the author of books, including Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, and the founder of the climate campaign known as 350.org. Thanks for coming on.
Brian, many thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.